Blog Talk Radio.
Don't mind if you got something nice to say about me. I enjoy an accolade like the rest. And you could take my picture and hang it in a gallery of all the who's who's and so and so's that used to be the best at such and such.
And experts on a wide range of topics for professionals to help you leave your legacy. Today we have an amazing lineup to talk about innovation, leadership, investment insights in the travel industry, and growth. It's Tuesday, February 10th, and we are coming to you from sunny Tampa, Florida today. We've had some interesting weather over the last couple of weeks like the rest of the nation. Our sponsor today is WCities. If you're going on a trip, check out your destination on WCities.com. We have a great lineup today. Starting at 10 o'clock, we're going to be talking about innovation with Joe Calloway. At 10:30, we're going to switch gears to leadership with a good friend of mine, Ken Jennings. At 11 o'clock, we're going to talk about the travel industry and investment insights and should you be investing in the travel industry, with Jake Tapper. And at 11:30, we're going to wrap up talking about growth with Joe Pine. I would like to start this morning by just welcoming Joe Calloway. Joe, we were introduced by a very good friend of mine, Tracy Downing, here in Tampa. And I am just so excited because I actually, she was here a couple of weeks ago and we were talking about who I should have on my show. And she said, well, you really need to have Joe Calloway. And I walked over to my bookshelf, and I proudly pulled off your book, Becoming a Category of One.
Fun.
And I am just an avid reader of both business books and actually all genres. But that particular book really jumped out at me a couple of years ago. So I think the best way to start our conversation this morning is really to talk about why innovation is important for anybody. And you know, we talked last week on this show with Nancy, the former CEO of CBS Radio, and talked about how R&D isn't just about technology. So why don't you start right there?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's the jump that people have to make, Chickie, is you hear the word innovation, and you immediately think technology or R&D or product. And there are people that think, well, you know, innovation's a great thing, but it doesn't really have anything to do with me because I'm primarily in sales or marketing or HR, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, innovation is really just a matter of improving on what's there. Sometimes innovation can be as big a change as completely replacing what's there with something else. But anybody that believes that they have to get better at what they do on a continuing basis, by definition, believes in innovation.
And so where do they start? And can people really make a difference in their own job by starting with looking at how they do things and maybe making a list of stuff to stop, you know, which is always
yeah.
my favorite as a consultant?
You know, it's interesting. You just hit on one of my hot buttons, which is one approach to innovation is to say, because the temptation, Chickie, is to always think, okay, what else do we need to be doing?
Mm-hmm.
But one of the real keys and something that can be not only innovative but incredibly liberating is to think, as you just said, what do we need to stop doing or what do I need to let go of? What am I doing that I shouldn't be doing? All right, that's one approach. If you look at your day, if there is such a thing as a typical day for any of us anymore, and just to look at the steps that you take in your day and say, wait a minute, which of these do I not need to be doing? Which of these is a low production activity? That can be one pathway into innovation. Another is simply, here's the thing, it doesn't have to be rocket science. It usually isn't. If you have if you have a telephone call with a client, when you hang up the phone, simply take a couple of minutes and think, okay, what was it about that call that could have been better, that I could have done better?
Mm-hmm.
And then the key is to get to process, where it's not just, you know, random improvements, but where you say, wait a second, how can I make every call better? One innovation that I did in my business was I removed a barrier between me and the client or the
mm-hmm.
prospective client. What I was doing, Chickie, was the way the system was set up is the client had to talk to somebody else before they talked to me. And I decided, pardon me, that the highest and best use of my time was, in fact, for that client to have direct access to me and cut out the people in the middle.
Right.
So what I did was let go of something, excuse me again, let go of something which was a process that was actually a barrier between me and client contact, and we're already getting feedback that everybody's much, much happier. It's helping me generate more business.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm having conversations now that I never had with them before. And so, it doesn't have to be rocket science. It can.
Right.
It's usually something right under your nose.
Well, Joe, so you can grab a little drink of water. Hopefully you've got one close by or can find someone who has one. I wanted to talk just a minute. You know, as I look at your client list and the folks, you know, I mean, clearly it's a who's who in business, Saks Fifth Avenue, BMW, American Express, IBM.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think the interesting thing we're facing right now, and I just got off the phone a little while ago with Jake Fuller, who's going to be on the phone with me at 11 to talk about investing right now. And, you know, we were talking about how in our industry, you know, I've focused the bulk of my career on the travel industry, that, you know, the travel industry has gone through this time frame where everybody who is significant in this industry is owned by private equity, and they went from being private to public and back to private. And, you know, these companies have all come in and done, you know, incredible cost cutting. And so when they look at process improvements, in the past, they've been able to afford, you know, Bain and McKinsey and
yep.
Accenture to come in and do these kinds of things. And I think, you know, actually the cool thing for you and me now is that in the current economy, you know, people who laid off all of those folks in the fourth quarter and hit January 1st with, oh, my God, I still have the same business plan for this
yeah.
year, and I still have all the same goals that my shareholders and investors are going to demand on me. So now what do I do? You know, and I think those of us who focus on, you know, coming in with a laser, you know, rather than a huge scalpel
yeah.
are going to actually do well in this economy.
Well, I tell you, you mentioned this economy. It's interesting, and it happens every time there's a recession. A downturn, certainly what we're in right now qualifies as an economic crisis. And I tell you why it can be a real boost to your innovation. You know, I hear people say, and I totally get where they're coming from, they say, I'm not going to participate in the recession. Well, my approach is to say that you should dive into the recession absolutely head first and totally participate in the recession, because a recession creates opportunities. I heard not too long ago that a recession is a reallocation of money from the scared to the bold.
Oh,
and
I
so
like that.
I do too. I really like that. And so what a recession does, and what an economy like we've got right now does, is it forces innovation. There's nothing like a crisis to help people clarify and help people start to take a whole different look at the way they're doing their business. I've got friends that are in a business that has been hammered by this economy simply because of the nature of their business. They went through a period of some very, very painful cutbacks and reevaluations, and yet now they're starting to see the other side of that process, which is, hey, you know, the way we're going to have to do things now, gosh, that might have made sense all along. And so they're starting to innovate in ways that they never would have thought of if the economy hadn't forced them to.
Right.
So there's a lot of ways that this economy can, you know, if you can get through it, great thing. I'm using it to reposition, to rethink. I'm totally planning on gaining ground and gaining market share in this economy because so many people are out there in a defensive position, mm-hmm. and I'm going to take full advantage of that.
Oh, you know, I think that's so true, and it's funny because I was just thinking about that last night. One of my main competitors in the market that I serve in the travel industry is a company who does really large conferences, and, you know, they always have just amazing speakers, and it is absolutely a must-attend event every year.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it occurred to me last night, I'm doing that 3 times a week now.
Yeah.
You know, because of using new technology and just deciding to do it. And, you know, I want to come back to your book, Becoming a Category of One, because I think as an author, you should be really interested in what I highlighted when I read this
Listen,
book.
I'm especially interested because I'm right now, Chickie, writing the revised and updated version, which will be out in August.
Oh, really?
Cool. Tell me what you're thinking. I want to hear it.
Well, there are a couple of things that jumped right out at me, and I think that this is so apropos for where we are in the economy. Actually, in the preface of that book, you talked about companies, extraordinary companies who have a clear sense of who they are, and they define themselves not in the terms of what they sell,
mm-hmm.
their product, their
right.
services, but in terms of what the point is for their employees, stakeholders, and customers.
Right.
And, I mean, that one... And, you know, we can talk about that before I go on to the other one because the other one is actually quite different. But, you know, I haven't read your book on being indispensable, but
uh-huh.
I can only imagine that it's all about that.
Well, let me tell you a part of that book. In Indispensable, I talk about the 5 drivers, which is just a way to organize some ideas. But one of them does have to do with this understanding who you are, and it really has to do with how you can think innovatively with your customers, because if you define who you are by what you sell, then obviously that's what you talk to potential customers and customers about. If you define yourself by what you're all about and what the point is, you tend to start thinking about your customers the same way. I had what turned out to be my biggest client and remains my biggest client, has been for about 5 years now. I was in the office of the CEO. He said, this was one of the greatest things a customer's ever said to me. He said, very few vendors end up sitting in this office with me. He said, do you know why you're here? And I said, no, but I'd love to. Tell me. He said, because you get us. You're not just trying to sell us a product or a service. You're trying to help us go where we want to go, and you get it where we want to go. You get who we are and what we're about. And so in Indispensable, I call that taking a big-picture approach to your business. And if you start to do that and think, wait a minute, and I would guess that probably most of your listeners do this to a certain extent, but pay attention to how powerful it can be to think in terms of big picture, what is my customer trying to accomplish? And how can I fit into that big picture?
Well, and I'm also finding that because what a lot of folks are trying to accomplish right now is still stuck in that paralysis of I got to cut costs, got to cut costs,
yep.
got to cut costs, and they're not ready to take that next step of innovation. The other thing that absolutely jumped out at me, and it's funny because I read this book, I don't know what year this came out. Was it
5 years ago? 2003.
Okay. Well, it was shortly after that. I was working with a very large client on a project that was actually, you know, about reaching customers through multiple channels.
Mm-hmm.
And you quote in really the first chapter I see is a phrase called, we just decided to go.
Yeah,
and it's about the movie Apollo 13.
Yep.
And, you know, it's recounting the state where Jim Lovell is looking up at the moon and,
mm-hmm.
you know, thinking what a huge leap that is. And, you know, in fact, of course, you know, the original words of Armstrong of one small step for man,
right.
giant leap for mankind. You know, and he's musing on this with his wife. And about 3 months ago, I was sitting in the office of a CEO of a very, very large company in our industry, and I told him I didn't come in with a PowerPoint. I didn't come in with any kind of presentation. I came in with two sticky notes, and I put them in front of him, and one was a chart of where he was making his money versus where the money in the industry could be made.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the other one was just a simple diagram to help him be customer-centric in his thinking rather than product-centric.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the interesting thing. I used the story of Apollo 13
yeah.
about when they were, you know, stuck up in space and they only had what they had to
mm-hmm.
fix the problem. But everybody on the ground wanted to muse about why they shouldn't have had the problem to begin with, why they should never have taken off.
Right.
And what they were going to do if and when they got back to fix it and never have this problem again. It's like, no, guys, you know, all you've got is what you've got. And you got to find somebody who's passionate about it. And they, you know, they finally pulled in the guy who had been replaced by Kevin Bacon.
Yeah, because
you know,
he had, the measles or something.
Yeah, but, you know, he was the one who was passionate about getting them down. He knew what it was like. And it's so funny because I've got the movie Apollo 13 in DVD, sitting on my desk, waiting to send to the CEO because nothing has happened since that meeting to fix the problem of running out of oxygen in their industry.
Let me tell you something. It's amazing the number of clients that I'll go back to their events year after year. As a matter of fact, I was at one just a few months ago, and I didn't have to say it because one of the senior executive leadership team got up and said, guys, do you realize we've been talking about this same issue for probably 4 years. We either need to get on with it or let it go. It's like the old Fisher cut bait. The thing, you know, that's one of the things that gets in the way of innovation, though, is people say, yeah, but what if it's a mistake? What if it doesn't work? What if it doesn't fail? One of my favorite quotes is from a guy named Sir Kenneth Robinson, and he said, if you're afraid to fail, you will never do anything the least bit creative. And I was working with a division of actually Honeywell a few weeks ago, and this particular division said, look, I love their approach to the recession. The head of the division said, listen, gang, this thing's not going to last forever, and we don't want it to go by and everything get better in the economy, and we look over our shoulders and say, oh, my gosh, we missed it. We missed our chance to do something extraordinary when everybody else was kind of hunkered down and playing defense. And they said, what we've got to do is we've got to fail fast and we've got to fail often. Because now is the time to try a lot of new things. Because you've got clients out there that are looking for somebody coming from a position of strength, which they are, but that's also willing to assume the role of leadership and start taking the industry in different positions. But there, oh my gosh, there are so many companies and entrepreneurs that get frozen. And they know, here's the thing, they know what they need to do next.
But they don't know how to fail fast, though, and I think you really hit on something important there, because learning how to fail fast is the only thing that can get you to that place where you're willing to take the risk.
It absolutely is.
And I just decided I'm going to send your book and the Apollo 13 video and a note saying that Joe Calloway and I will come in and help you solve this problem. So you've been an inspiration in my business and perhaps in yours this morning.
You know what? You just hit on something, though, that's kind of interesting, and it gets to something else that I wanted to say about innovation. You said you have to learn to fail fast. And the context within which you said it is that it becomes part of your culture. Even for a one-person
right.
business, your business still has a culture. And that's the same thing about innovation. The mistake that a lot of people make is they say, I'm going to go off, or I'm going to take my three partners and we're going to go off, or we're going to take 50 people from this department and we're going to go off for 2 days and we're going to conjure up some great new ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not usually where good innovation comes from. Listen, everybody out there, I bet, would agree that their best ideas come when they are taking a walk, when they're mowing the yard, when they're in the shower. They just pop into your head. And so what that means is it's not about having an exercise in innovation. It's about having a culture of innovation.
Mm-hmm.
Just like having a culture of we're going to fail fast. You
right.
have a culture of we're not occasionally going to be on the lookout for great ideas. We're always going to be on the lookout for great ideas. By the way, one part of that kind of innovation culture is to be incredibly curious. And
oh,
always,
I love that word.
Yeah, always look at what's going on in other businesses. When you walk through the mall and you see something that really impresses you as being cool, the thing to do is stop and say, okay, am I doing that in my business? What would my version of this look like? Mm. That's a great way to innovate. It's when you see a good idea in a business that has nothing to do with yours, just stop and say, okay, this is a good idea. What would my version of that look like?
I like that. And tell me a little bit about work like you're showing off. What's the premise behind that?
Work like you're showing off is a little different. The becoming a Category 1 and indispensable, we're really businessy. They're about, you know, how you manage and strategize and some leadership. Work like you're showing off is both more directed to the individual, and it's also, gosh, it's kind of half work, half just life stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And what it is actually just a number of observations. It's funny, I don't consider myself as being particularly smart, but I'm a good reporter. And so work like you're showing off is an exercise in what is it that not top companies necessarily, but top performers, looking at individuals, what do they have in common? What are some of the traits that they all hold together? One, it's funny, we were just talking about it, but in work like you're showing off, I call it grand stupidity and absurd bravery. Listen, I say in the book, the advantage of experience is in knowing what works, but the great disadvantage of experience is in the loss of grand stupidity and the absurd bravery that comes from not knowing what works. When you don't know what works, you'll try anything. You'll be too ignorant to play it safe. You'll be ridiculous and audacious. You'll discover all the new things that work, and you'll have all the fun. So it's more that kind of book.
Huh, interesting. Well, I'm dealing with a whole lot of people, as you might imagine, that are in transition right now. People
sure.
who, you know, for 10 and 20 years have been holding senior executive positions with corporations and are now trying to figure out, you know, where they want to go and what they want to do. So,
yeah.
you know, a lot of those types of resources are things that I'm sharing with my group right now, those that I mentor on that front. So that's really terrific. Let's talk about what gets in the way of being innovative.
You know, we've already touched on a couple of them. One is quite simply the fear of risk, the fear of what if it doesn't work. Here's the thing. Number one, when you try something, even when it doesn't work, you're going to get some good information. You're going to get feedback. The other thing is, one barrier is that we think we have to see the finished product. And by product, I mean result. There's a wonderful analogy. I love this. It says you can drive all the way across the country from New York to San Francisco driving only at night, and you can make it the whole way only seeing 200 feet in front of you at any given time.
Mm.
Just take the next 200 feet. Try it. You'll get some information. If you're wrong, that's fine. You'll get feedback and information that will help you correct course. Listen, committees are notorious for being non-innovative because, and most of us have experienced it, somebody throws an idea on the table, and if it's a good, safe idea, everybody agrees and says, well, we ought to do that. But if it's a truly, truly, truly innovative idea, the reaction tends to be, you know, things like, listen, Chicky, nobody in this industry has ever done that, and there's probably a good reason they've never done that. And it looks like it would be too expensive, and I just don't think we've got the – and you just go on and on
right.
with this litany of why it won't work. Innovative individuals and companies have a mindset that says, okay, that sounds pretty weird, so let's stay with it. I think it was Edison that said – Thomas Edison that said, if an idea doesn't appear completely foolish at first, it's probably not even worth pursuing.
I like that.
You know, the other thing is we get caught in the trap of becoming experts. meaning the attitude of, look, I know how this business works. And what you need to do, actually somebody else coined this phrase, but I loved it. They said that their goal was to go to work stupid every day and not thinking that they know how it works. I love the story of the little girl in kindergarten who was drawing a picture, and the teacher came over and said, what are you drawing? And she said, I'm drawing a picture of God. And the teacher kind of laughed and said, but honey, nobody knows what God looks like. And the little girl says, they will in a couple of minutes. See, I wish I had more of that attitude. Because as we get older, we tend to lose that. But you've got to fight to hang on to that, you know, what if, why not, and that passionate curiosity that does drive ideas.
Well, and kids actually are so good at that. And, you know, I call it the, you know, Dumbo is my hero approach, where, you know, Dumbo had no idea that he should not be able to fly.
Exactly.
And, you know, I mean, other people use the hummingbird as that example. But,
you're right.
You know, I mean, I think that the really cool thing is, and I guess it does take a special kind of person or a special approach to risk to do that. Because, I mean, quite literally, the idea for the Solutions Live Social Broadcasting Network came to me on January 10th. And I launched on the 27th, and anybody involved in any kind of broadcasting or, you know, hosting a radio show would say, you know, absolutely not.
You can't do that. Yeah, you can't do it. That's too fast.
But it's been such a blast. And, you know, I tell you, it just, but, I don't have a huge fear of risk. So, you know, that could be the reason. You know, we talked a little bit about creativity. I mean, you didn't talk about lack of creativity as a barrier. Do you think people have to be creative?
No, they really don't. What they have to be is observant. You can actually be, you don't have to be a creative, artistic thinker to be innovative. You can be very grounded in logic. And listen, I'm the kind of person, there are people that say, look, I'm not an innovator because I have to see step one, step two, step three. That's fine. When you go to the mall and you spot an idea that looks like a really great idea, okay, step one. What are the mechanics of what this store is doing? Let's tear their idea apart. Step two, what would our version be of that? And you don't have to be wildly creative. You simply put the pieces together. And then step three would be what you did with your broadcasting, which is the execution of it. I'm a great fan of, well, I'm a great believer that most innovation is not some brand new idea. It's simply adapting an existing idea in a new way.
Mm-hmm.
That's what innovation is 99% of the time. You take an existing idea and say, you know, that works over there. What if we tried it over here? So it's not about being wildly creative. It's about being observant and curious and then willing to execute.
Well, one of my favorite terms when describing someone is that they're intellectually curious.
Yeah.
And, you know, I find when I pick up books in the bookstore when I'm going through the airport and I gravitate toward business books, it is that intellectual curiosity that comes out of me. And, you know, and I'm a sucker for a great cover. And I got to tell you, You're Becoming a Category of One was one of the greatest covers of all times that just jumped off the shelf.
I love that cover. It's followed by the next book, which I think has actually kind of turned out to be kind of a dull cover. I need to go back and redo it.
Well, you know, I mean, clearly marketing is all about that branding and jumping off the page. Well, in the last minute that we have, Joe, what is the one little piece of advice that you would leave with folks about innovation?
It's listen, I can't do better than what you referenced a few minutes ago in the chapter I started Becoming a Category of One with, and what most successful entrepreneurs, leaders, CEOs would say, which is tell them to go. Tell them to get on with it. Tell them to pull the trigger. Tell them to light the fuse. Stop thinking about it and do it. You will learn what you need, the rest of what you need to know, if you go ahead and start. Honestly, that's one of the most powerful business ideas I know, is go on and start.
Well, I have had a tremendous time getting to know you a little bit better, and I am hoping that you and I are going to do a little consulting project together about Apollo 13. It would
yeah.
be tremendous fun. Well, thank you so much, and you have a great rest of your day.
You too. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, terrific. I want to stop again and thank our sponsor for today, W Cities, and then would like to get our next guest on.
Ken.
Ken. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, let me make an introduction. Ken Jennings is the managing director of Third River Partners, a leader development and strategy execution consultancy working with senior executive teams to achieve dramatic business results. Well, that's what leadership is all about, is results. Ken and I met, almost 2 years ago through a mutual friend and someone who has supported my business ventures. And when I thought about leadership, I always think about Ken because he holds near and dear to his heart a concept called servant leadership. Ken, tell us a little bit about, first of all, you've got a couple of books. One is 10,000 Horses, which is the subtitle of that book is How Leaders Harness Raw Potential for Extraordinary Results. And then your more current book, I actually don't have a copy of yet, but I'm going to head out and get that. So tell us how you came to write those books.
Well, the two books, The Serving Leader and 10,000 Horses, I actually wrote with my best friend, John Stalwart. John is an inner city pastor in Pittsburgh. And, of course, I'm kind of on the other end of the continuum of a pastor that stays put in one city. I'm kind of traveling all the time around the country. Oddly enough, John and I became best friends, and I actually moved to Pittsburgh 2.5 years ago and bought the house next door to John's family.
Oh, wow.
So we're in community together and kind of an odd couple, and we've written these two books together and bring our various perspectives. John focuses on leadership development from a nonprofit perspective. He's a working CEO of one of the country's largest foundations. I'm a management consultant and coach. So the fact that we would write together is puzzling. The fact that two guys, a Mennonite and an ex-military officer, would become best friends is puzzling to people.
Mm-hmm.
So part of this came out of our friendship and our perspective on what effective leadership looks like.
Mm-hmm.
I still have you, Chicky?
Yes, you do. You just dropped for a second.
Yeah, so that's a bit about the writing partnership. If you wish, I could talk a little bit about either of the books or what we're doing with them now.
Well, I want to talk about it all. So tell me, though, how you came from being involved in the military to getting into leadership consulting. I know some people who haven't had a firsthand experience in the military would wonder how that transition occurs.
You know, probably not conventional thinking. Most people think of, I would say many people think of the military as autocratic, paternalistic, do what I tell you. Actually, the elite military is much different from that. It's much more team decision-making. I came out of Appalachia. I went to the Air Force Academy, where for 4 years it's a crucible of leadership, learning it, being led, then becoming a leader, then going on to assignments around the world where you're put in a position to lead and observe other great leaders. Interestingly enough, my oldest son, David, has been emailing me today, is in his second combat assignment somewhere in the Middle East. He's in special operations, and I had the privilege of being his graduation speaker when he got a leadership award. Apparently he was paying attention over those years. So I just became obviously interested in the impact of leadership. You can't prepare yourself to take young men and women into harm's way without thinking deeply about leading. So then later I went into a doctoral program and really focused on what it takes to design and then lead great organizations. Business school professor, multiple places. And the more I kind of combine my practical observations of great leaders with a studied interest in looking at the underpinnings conceptually of leadership, I got to put together kind of the practical and the more conceptual and academic to practice. And then I'd say I've been very fortunate the last 20 years to work with terrific CEOs and leaders from all around the world in different industries, and both help them, and then we're all in this together when I work with clients, a living laboratory of what actually works from a leadership perspective. That honestly then is what led us to the principles in the Serving Leader book. They're very contrarian. Much of what is taught in business schools, I think, are not conventional wisdom doesn't really work with regard to leadership. Okay. So we took a very different approach with this book, and I think probably surprised a number of people that we're not writing about the conventional wisdom in leadership.
Well, and I certainly came during my corporate days out of a command and control leadership structure. I worked for a number of years for a division of American Airlines, and you know, had been very, very oriented in financial performance, and not so much in those days about the customer. And you know, if you don't have a serving attitude about your customers, you know, it's also hard to have a serving attitude about your team. So you know, in the Serving Leader, you know, what's the one takeaway out of that book?
You know, I think the Serving Leader, a basic takeaway is that to be an effective leader, you get your ego out of the way. That I think Jim Collins pointed this out in Good to Great when he described level five leaders as having a great deal of personal humility, but then coupled with that, a fierce resolve to do whatever it takes to be successful. High ego leaders fail. You can probably think this through logically, mm-hmm. because those around them don't care enough to lend them innovative ideas or help them succeed. They give off the signals that I can do it on my own. Low ego leaders give the opposite impression. They give the very clear idea that I need your help, and if you help me, I'm going to give you credit for it, not myself.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd say we had five different actions that we describe with Serving Leaders. That would be a foundational one.
Mm. Who would you say influenced you most as a leader in your career?
You know, that's an easy one. I'd say my dad. My dad was a huge influence, and I got to watch him growing up. My dad was a home builder, and back when we could definitely not afford it, he bought significant acreage outside of our little town in West Virginia and declared to us, I think we were astonished, that someday this is going to be full of houses and roads, and I'm looking at farmland with cows and barns,
mm-hmm.
and I couldn't envision it. And then I observed and participated with my dad, who bartered land for roads, worked to learn all the trades as he employed tradesmen to build houses, and then loved people along the way so that he created homes that families lived in. He created a sense of community, and when he went through very tough times, he didn't panic. I had a kind of a close encounter with a pretty terrific leader, no kidding. So I think I got that in my gut, and I include him in the books. There's a lot of him in what I write.
And interesting that you use the term love in the same breath as a leader. Do you believe that actually plays a role in being able to serve?
Well, sure. I think the whole person comes to work. And if you view people who come to work as simply there to apply their muscle or their brain to the task, they ferret that out. When you as a leader are communicating because of who you are that you genuinely care for people, they want to bring their whole selves to the work. So an authentic leader, a transparent leader, a loving leader, doesn't fake it. They really care for people. And that leads them to do something pretty spectacular. They then look deeply at people around them and they say, you're gifted at this. Your strengths are this. And I care enough to raise the bar on you, to ask you to give your very best around this strength. Someone who cares enough to get insight into people then has earned the right to challenge them to work hard against the goals of the organization through this set of signature gifts and strengths. That's perhaps an unintended consequence of being a loving leader, but it's a pretty dramatic one.
Well, it's interesting because that kind of bridges us over to talking about 10,000 Horses, because and when I first read this book, I was tremendously impacted by it. And it's written as a bit of an allegorical story,
sure,
longer than some of the other ones that were coming out at the same time. What can you tell us about that book? Because it's exactly about that, harnessing the potential, you know, believing in people perhaps when other people don't.
Well, we set the book fictionally in Colorado in a foster home that also has something to do with wild Mustangs. I won't give the storyline away, but in the setting, you have a group of foster kids who, by very definition, have been rejected by others, and into that situation is a leader who is pouring out his life into these young boys and girls to turn their lives around, search for a greater purpose, and work as teams. So then we had a business owner fictionally come into the situation to learn from how these children are setting goals and objectives for their lives, working in teams, and he extrapolates lessons from what he observes in the children back to his business in New York. That storyline allowed us then to take pretty far the story of building teams where you care for each other and pursuing a greater goal, and that these concepts are simple, even children can learn them, and then how this young man, who probably stands for all of us, takes the principles back to his business and along the way has a life transformation. Because leadership is not just about knowing things, it's about being differently. It's not doing things differently, it's about being differently. So 10,000 Horses follows the same approach we've used in our other books that tell principles of leadership, but in a story that's hopefully meaningful and gripping. We get great feedback. I'll be going with my co-author, John, in April to launch 10,000 Horses in China. It's in Chinese now, serving leaders in like 7 languages around the world. I think you may have my friend Joe Pine on today. Joe and I traveled to China together.
Oh, you did. Cool. Well, you know, it's funny because Joe Calloway knows him too, and I had Joe on first. So.
Oh, okay. Yes, Joe is a good friend, and we both went. I think he spoke to his experience economy work. Now his new book, Authenticity, we went over and spoke on the serving leader, and I'll be going back again in April with my co-author to speak about 10,000 Horses. I really love it. It's a beautiful cover in Chinese. The Chinese have done a fabulous job. I'm curious about what questions we'll get from Chinese entrepreneurs that we'll be speaking to.
Oh, really? That sounds fascinating. Very, very interesting. Well, I would love to see what the cover looks like. So in the introduction to the book, you talk about it being a leadership fable. Were there bits and pieces of real stories that got woven in there, or was it a piece of fiction?
Well, you know, it's always the truth that we bring our whole selves to writing and our tasks. So there's a whole lot of me and a whole lot of John in there. Our wins, our losses, our insights, what we've observed from other clients, our heart. So being business writers that choose to write through fiction, we get to bring a lot more of our whole selves into it. And storytelling is the way we've communicated for thousands of years. So we like to tell stories that communicate great truths. And it's one thing, I've been a business professor at Columbia and University of Michigan and lots of places around the world. It's one thing to write a business article, just the facts. It's another to try to pour your heart and a bit more of you into a story. That's what we try to do here.
Well, you absolutely succeeded on that front. I remember not being able to put the book down, and actually it's been 2 years since I have read it, so I think it's time for me to go back and do it again, especially with what I've gone through in the last 2 years in my entrepreneurial journey, which you and I need to catch up on offline. The one thing that comes across, and again, I don't want to give away the storyline or the equation that comes out of the book, but 10,000 Horses talks a lot about engagement.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's not a word that tends to get used a lot with leadership, and particularly the old command and control type of leader didn't really care if anybody was engaged. It was just, you know, just do what I say because I've said it. So how does that change? How does engagement change because of servant leadership and the serving leader's heart?
Well, I think, it goes, for me, it goes back to who you are as a leader first. You first engage an important person. You engage yourself. An entrepreneur, a leader, is first of all someone who's deeply passionate about the outcomes of the organization, the team, the people they're leading. So you engage because you yourself as a leader have chosen to stay in a spot. By your presence, you're announcing it's important. You believe in the product or the service. Then you can invite others to become engaged by relating their strengths and gifts and what they're doing every day to help achieving the greater purpose of the organization. So there's a virtuous cycle here that this starts with you being engaged, engaging yourself, and then having a chance with that, then given permission to engage others as a leader. You don't get it automatically just because you're named in a position. Often a mistake. We use the word promotion or supervision, super above, watching from above. It's a mistake to think that you're automatically being followed because you're in a position. You earn that right, and you first earn it by articulating the greater goal that you're driving toward, inviting people to be part of it, and then backing that up by proving that you're trustworthy in the good times and bad times. That's what a serving leader really does. I'm predicting, because we're a part of this, that it's time for Plan B in terms of leadership. Plan A, I'm in charge, you're not. Get all the dollars, portion out what's left for others. That plan hasn't worked, and I think we're aware of it. So I'm predicting and seeing a much more significant openness to looking at this contrarian style of leadership, the servant leader approach, engaging with others. And I think we need to take this as an opportunity to help people unlearn what they were taught and relearn something that honestly is more healthy for us as people to lead this way, where you can love people you're with, where you can help them accomplish in a team setting what you all set out to do with greater goals. This is the way we're wired up.
Right.
So it fits.
Well, I was actually going to ask next, and I think you really just addressed it. You know, how do those leadership requirements differ during economic crisis? And you know, clearly it's not just behaviors that have to change, but, you know, entire organizations. And I just talked with Joe Calloway about innovation and how people think about innovation, you know, during these times. And it's not always just doing, you know, what else do you need to do, but what do you need to stop doing? And what approach do you use with your coaching clients when you come in? And you're typically working with the CEO and the board, is that correct?
Right. Well, one thing I do that, again, you would expect me to say is quite contrarian. I love this phrase. It may have come from Drucker. I'll attribute it to him, that the future is all already with us. It's simply unequally distributed. I look for what a leader is doing and what in the organization is occurring that's already aligned with the future, that's already working well, even if it's in a small experiment. Leadership is about listening for faint signals of success and then amplifying them. So I look for what's already working well and then reinforce the living daylights out of it. I did a 10-city tour with one of my clients looking at a U.S.-wide sales force. Most of these reviews are done by going around and looking for where people are messing up and calling them on the carpet. I suggested we do this differently. Let's go and look for where people are having micro successes, that small things that we can honor, respect, and amplify. And then over time, you keep amplifying what's working. You then wind up with an organization full of good practice. We pretend that's not true with reengineering and other more mechanical approaches that say much of what we're doing is bad. Let's re-engineer it, redesign it.
Right.
The serving leader, I think, amplifies what's good.
And how do you, from a practical perspective, get them to retrain themselves? And it really is creating a new culture, right? I mean, you're doing a complete culture shift for these organizations. It has to start at the top.
Well, you know, it's not as hard as one might imagine. Reengineering a culture actually starts with one person at a time. It really is spotting good-hearted intentions and saying, I learned this from my friend Noel Tishy. Noel built Crotonville for GE and Jack Welch. Noel and I ran a healthcare leadership program for a while together. He used to say that an effective way of serving leaders working is to see what's going in the right direction again and just simply use this phrase, do more of that. That thing you just did, do more of it. And I really had wild success with that with a Japanese client. They really took that to heart and began giving each other feedback. Do more of that when they spotted their colleagues doing things that were culturally consistent and in the right direction. And honestly, it becomes viral then. You don't have to set up a giant culture change engine. It's much more simple.
Mm.
You know, I have to say, we don't do large engagements. We tackle large things. And we have great success by starting in a small way, but recruiting the entire organization to be our colleagues. So at the end of the day, we're serving each other. And I'm getting ready to fly out this afternoon to an organization in the West Coast, one of the world's great diabetes companies that deserves greater success because they're literally pushing back diabetes. And this is the approach we've taken, is to take on a culture change that says we can all do this together. Let's give each other feedback when we move in the right direction. And it's as really as simple as that. It's not a big, you don't need a PhD to do this.
Mm-hmm.
You need a determined heart that looks for what to reinforce.
I really like that. You know, one of the things that occurred to me over my experiences with the last couple of years, and just to kind of bring you up to speed, you know, I went through an entrepreneurial venture and what I would call my first, even though I've been out on my own with my own company for 13 years. I think you don't become an entrepreneur until you pay payroll with MasterCard and Visa. And my husband and I really learned a lot through that endeavor. But there was a point in time almost 2 years ago when our investment bankers were telling us that we needed, you know, a seasoned, experienced leadership team and that needed to be, you know, people from brand name companies that people were going to recognize. And that as an entrepreneur and as the founder, that I wasn't capable of being that leader. And, you know, I mean, that was a really tough pill to swallow, especially since, you know, I had the passion about getting things done. I mean, I think you know just from the one time we met. But I came to this crossroads, and in particular where we needed operational leadership, and I looked at the difference between a CEO and a COO. And I had this moment where I thought, you know, can you take someone and give them a CEO title, and does that make them a leader? Or are certain people just more capable of operationally running something? And, you know, that COO and president isn't just a title, it's actually a description of the individual. So my question to you isn't so much about that topic, but do you believe leaders are actually born, or are they made by the crucible of experience, and can anyone rise to that position if they can actually become a servant first?
You know, I think it's like maybe it's an analogy in between the two. Leaders can be cultivated. I have a friend who's a client named Joe Patternchak. Joe is the head of human resources for our client, the Cleveland Clinic. And he played football at a very high level, he and his twin brother, along the way, was encouraged to step up as a leader, both on the field and then off the field. When he describes his career to me, all the way back then, someone challenged him to step up, and they said, "I see it in you to step up." And along the way, he took more and more leadership roles, so that when he came into the clinic, he took a look around, respected what they've done, but as a leader said, we need to become better serving leaders. And I'm not afraid to say, look at me. You can look at my life. He didn't just suddenly, wasn't just birthed as a leader. He was shaped all along the way to then have the confidence and competence to put himself in that position to say, get the ball to me. Look at me. He took more and more chances, more and more to grow as a leader.
Mm-hmm.
He grew into it. He was cultivated into it. Now he's doing the same for others. I see the team that he's assembled there, and I just have to say, good for you, Joe. This is you've now taken the next step to grow leaders yourself. That's how it happens. We are the beneficiaries, like I was for my father and military officers, to grow as a leader. And now my life ambition is to pass it along, to grow leaders, not just CEOs, but emerging leaders. I have a passion for growing leaders, and I think it's an obligation. We have to cultivate the next generation. So I'm not sure I directly answered your question. It's neither born nor developed. It's cultivated is the word I would use.
I love that. Okay, well, if you wanted to leave one thing, whether it's out of your books or out of your experience, what would you say to people who have an aspiration to be a leader, or someone who is, you know, kind of in the same place that Matt Jones was at the beginning of the book, of they've been in a leadership role and have been failing?
Right. Two things come to mind, and I believe this, that just within a few miles of every terrible problem we have in the world, crime, starvation, bitter issues, within a few miles are leaders capable of solving those problems, and they haven't stepped up. So the first thing is, when you see it, that's your chance to step up and lead. The second is, I'd say, is it's not what you think. Much of the conventional wisdom that we've been told as leadership is wrong, dead wrong, and that it's okay to listen to your heart about how to lead, because people want to be engaged with a whole person, that's you, to be led. So look for the opportunities and don't be afraid to listen to your heart, not just the popular books that are written on leadership, and you're going to be just fine. I'm really pleased that you'd offer me a chance to talk about our books. We have a new one coming we're working on called Greater, one word, and it's about pursuing something that's bigger than yourself at life and at work. So Greater is going to continue in the same stream of stepping up, but this time going after greater goals than just yourself.
Oh, that's great. And are you co-writing that with John again?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, you know what? I would love it if you could make an electronic introduction to John, because I have a show on Thursday afternoon about giving. And, you know, he has certainly lived a life of that, and I would absolutely love to have him on my show.
I'll pass it along to you as soon as we hang up.
That would be great. Well, thank you so much, Ken. I'm hoping that you and I get a chance to catch up here when you get back from your travels. And have a blessed day.
Thank you so much. See you later.
Take care. Okay, I want to thank again our sponsor for today, WCities. If you are traveling or even if you just want to check out what's going on in your own city, go to www.wcities.com. All right, well, I am wanting to change focus again. We're going to move from talking about innovation and leadership to talking about investment. And I'm looking for my next guest, Jake. I'm seeing a different phone number than I'm expecting, so I'm going to take a chance. I'm a risk taker. Good morning, Jake. Is that you?
Good morning. Sorry to throw things off there for you.
That's okay. Hey, I'm nothing if not flexible. All right. Terrific. Well, Jake, why don't you tell us just a little bit about your background?
Well, I've been a travel and leisure analyst on Wall Street for, about 10 years now. Throughout most of that time, I've covered hotels, I've covered casinos, online travel companies, travel global distribution systems. And for most of the last 8 years, I've been with a West Coast-based firm, Thomas Weisel Partners, covering much of the same. You know, throughout that time, I've watched a couple of different ups and downs, the bursting of the internet bubble, the obvious aftermath of 9/11, and currently have a front row seat for the credit crunch that's unfolding and hitting the travel environment pretty hard. And I find myself striking out on my own these days.
Right, right. Well, I don't even remember what year you and I met, but since I have specialized in those same industries, I know we started running across each other at industry conferences where we were both asked to be on panels. So I am just delighted to have you as my co-host today to talk about two things that I'm pretty passionate about. And as we talked before the show, I love the fact that you and I don't always agree on these things, and that's okay too. We both consult with the investment community, and we talk to folks about investing in both public companies, and I spend a lot of time also working on the private side with companies that are investing in the debt in some of these companies that have been taken private by private equity firms.
Yes.
Jay, can you just tell me your observations about this cycle of, you know, these companies started out, and in particular the GDS companies, being owned by the airlines. The airlines spun off portions of their interest and then all of their interest in making these companies public. And, you know, some of them have kind of gone through this cycle multiple times or been sold or changed hands and now merged. What's your observation about the impact of that public and private transition we've been going through?
We're at a pretty intriguing time now. You know, late in 05 to 07, the capital markets were fairly friendly. You know, it was very easy to raise money and to do a buyout, and we saw a wave of activity across the economy, of course, but very certainly in the travel environment, whether it was hotels, casinos, and obviously the global distribution systems, all essentially shifted over to private equity owners. And that was fueled by the access to very low-cost, cheap capital. The idea at the time was these were good cash flow-producing businesses. You'd be able to buy them, pile on a lot of debt, and use that free cash flow over the next couple of years to pay down the debt and eventually spin them back out public at a nice return. Typically, these private equity investors, you know, target a 20% plus return, and that was the idea here. I remember sitting at an industry conference after all of this happened, and several of GDS executives stood up and sort of said, okay, this is going to be good because it's going to give us more ability to invest in developing our product. And my initial concern with that was that's not the way that works. You know, you buy these, you put on debt, you use the cash flow to pay your interest expense and pay down debt, and usually you cut costs and you pull money out of product and development. So I was very concerned for the industry and the ongoing longevity of the GDSs under private equity ownership. I find myself very surprised that we've actually seen ongoing investment by the global distribution systems. While they have piled on the debt and they do have big interest service to make every couple of months, they haven't really scaled back all that much on CapEx, and they do appear to be continuing to evolve their underlying product, even as the airline industry fairly drastically changes or seeks to change how they sell products. So I've been a bit surprised that it hasn't played out quite the way I expected.
Right.
But the next step's what I'm really worried about.
Right. Well, yeah. And for those who are listening who don't know what a GDS is, the global distribution system companies are the ones who essentially are the intermediaries, the technical intermediaries that connect buyers and sellers in the travel industry. So an airline will connect through a global distribution system company to reach the, you know, 18 to 19,000 travel agencies in the United States, including the online travel agencies. And while there are other ways that they can reach the consumer, the travel agency community has historically aggregated people who spend more on travel than those who shop online. And Jake, this is something that you and I had some heated discussion about this morning. So why don't you tell me your perspective, and then I'll tell you mine.
Well, you know, and keep in mind, the market is a fairly simple animal, and most of what I'm dealing with is the market and an investor who has a relatively simple view of how the world works. One of the main themes was, first of all, private equity ownership, and that was going to drastically change the business by scaling back R&D. The second big issue people were worried about was the internet makes connections a lot easier in a broadly defined sort of way. There's a general malaise in the market over whether or not the GDSs will be necessary. Going into the 06 negotiations, there was a lot of talk about, well, the internet makes the GDS antiquated and, you know, we'll no longer need them. And certainly going into the next series of negotiations, that's a major concern in the marketplace that, you know, the internet and connectivity has progressed to a level where these GDS companies are no longer necessary. Well, I don't believe that to be true. I think the market as a whole certainly has that simplistic view, and that's one of the major headwinds that I think the business faces. There's a prevailing view that direct connections between the large travel agents, whether they be online or offline, are not feasible and economically viable. I'm not convinced that's true, but there's certainly a prevailing sentiment that that will be a major theme over the next couple of years.
Well, and you mentioned those negotiations several years ago. You know, one of the catalysts that gave the airlines what I will call the bravado that they had in those negotiations was the fact that there were a couple of new entrants on the horizon. And, you know, ITA actually popped up in the 90s, you know, spurred on by some very, very clever and very intelligent guys up in Boston who came out of MIT. And you had Farelogix, who actually had a different mission out of the gate back in the early 2000-2001 timeframe. But they evolved to being called a global distribution system new entrant or a GDS buster. And then the third one was G2 Switchworks, which actually had some of its funding from the airlines who were trying to use them as a lever with the GDSs. And while I will say that their tact worked, conventional wisdom says it shouldn't have worked because the GDSs actually held all the power in that negotiation because they were the ones aggregating the high yield transactions. And, you know, I've told and certainly any investor that will listen and have said to a number of the CEOs of the GDS companies that they really should have just said, you don't like being connected to my 14,000 travel agencies here in the U.S. and countless agencies around the globe. What time tomorrow would you like for me to turn you off?
Funny enough, you know, and this goes back to an earlier discussion we had, keep in mind, as a Wall Street guy, my job is mostly to argue and take the opposite side of any argument. So, of course, I'll do that. I would argue the GDSs, surprisingly, came out of that round of negotiations whole. While the airlines propped up, I would argue artificially propped up these GDS alternatives at the time, and I think since it's been proven with, you know, the exit, if you will, of those three you mentioned, or at least the three you mentioned, you know, they're no longer really perceived to be viable alternatives. Nevertheless, they wielded them as a weapon. They appeared to have very successful cuts in the fees they were paying to the GDSs. What I would argue is, in my recent research, I've actually found that the bulk of the hit that the GDSs took was successfully passed on. Most of the reduction in fee that they suffered was passed on to their underlying travel agency base. And as far as I can see, with the relatively limited information that they put out there now, the cash flow that's produced by the GDS companies is not terribly dissimilar from the level it was at in prior to that round of negotiations.
Still not sure we should applaud simply passing that on to the retailer, because the retailer has taken all of the brunt of what's gone on in this industry, certainly for the last 10 years when the airlines decided that, you know, they no longer needed to pay commissions.
Arguing it was a good strategy,
right?
Just that it was a successful strategy from a financial standpoint. You know, we could argue about the right and wrongs of it, and I think we would actually probably agree with on that point. I'm simply arguing from a financial standpoint, the GDSs have held up surprisingly well given the scale of cut that they took at that time, you know, which is unfortunate for a whole, you know, segment of the industry, but they definitely appear to have come out whole. As best I can see with the data that we get, the revenue levels for the GDS companies are not dissimilar from what they were before the round of cuts. The segment levels are lower, and the EBITDA, the cash flow levels are similar. So
segment fees aren't lower, Jake. You know, when you take a look at their total distribution revenues divided by the number of bookings they have since 2001 when they first started making the cuts, when and I can't even remember what Sabre was the first one to do them, and the name is escaping me, but their average revenue per booking has gone up since then. And it's because they were able to increase their revenues from international transactions, from those same carriers who were, you know, talking them down domestically, and also from the other 580 who didn't have the leverage to come in and sit at the negotiation table.
Yeah, and they've certainly been, so they've followed a surprisingly successful strategy. And again, I'm not opining on the right and wrong of it, but they certainly appear to have held up their cash flow levels very well.
And let's talk about sustainability, because that's really the issue. Can they do the same thing again? Because the leverage isn't there now for the airlines of using, you know, G2 and ITA and Farelogix as levers. You know, G2 got bought by one of the GDSs. ITA is off building airline systems and not focusing so much on the travel agency desktop. And, you know, Farelogix continues to, you know, plod on, but, you know, has not taken the industry, you know, by storm and putting their product on all of the travel agency desktops. I mean, I'm certainly they continue to want to do that. And I applaud Jim Davidson for, you know, keeping his nose to the grindstone and knowing precisely what he wants to be as a company.
You'll be closer than I to the strategies they're actually taking now. I don't feel like they've developed enough to be ready for the next round of negotiations. They've certainly evolved their product. They can, you know, each of the GDSs continue to kind of carve out what their approach is going to be. Sabre being the content aggregator, Travelport trying to be the desktop application. Amadeus, it's not quite clear to me what their specific approach is. But I'm not convinced they're going to have enough of an angle going into this round. the airlines have certainly struggled in a way, gone through a very desperate period and have pretty quickly evolved the product they're selling and continue to want to make changes there. From what I can see from the outside, I think we're headed towards a pretty difficult period for the GDSs, not only from kind of a strategic standpoint, there's also the underlying ownership issue that's going to dramatically play into this next round of negotiations. Blackstone, which bought Travelport, and Texas Pacific Group, which bought Sabre, they did so at a time when capital was easy and cheap. They're left holding these companies now with a lot of debt and no defined exit strategy. Clearly, the plan when they bought them at the time was to lever them up, use the cash flow to pay down the debt within 3 to 5 years, take them back out into the public sphere. And, there was a ticking time clock in that process. You had to do that sometime by late 2009 because any buyer of these assets was going to be a forward-looking buyer. And if you're in 2009, they'll be looking at 2010, and that'll be fine and allow you to get that whatever the transaction you're pursuing is. However, the markets have shut down. You can't sell these assets now because no buyer can finance the purchase because there isn't access to capital right now. So that pushes you out until maybe 2010 when they began to pursue this strategy. Well, all of a sudden, any potential buyer is then looking at 2011 and saying, no way, I'm not going to buy into the teeth of that uncertainty. I don't know what your cash flow stream is going to look like beyond mid-2011. So not directly approaching the question, but kind of another tact, it feels to me like there are two things we need to think about. How are the GDSs positioning themselves to, for that next round of talks? Have they developed their product enough? And secondarily, is there going to be this whole financial issue that overhangs it? And if there is, that gives the airlines, fairly significant leverage in that round of talks.
Now, you and I were also talking a little bit, because of your background in both hospitality and gaming, about the Las Vegas market. And yep. My company, the Solutions Group, back in the 2001-2002 timeframe, built LasVegas.com for two of the major casino companies. And at the time, it was Mandalay and Park Place, which later renamed to Caesars. And, of course, both of them were subsumed later into MGM and Harrah's.
Yeah.
And when we went in that time frame, which again was right after a very, very difficult economic time and a very, very tough time for Las Vegas after 9/11, and occupancy levels were down significantly. Although when Las Vegas says that their occupancy is down, it means that it slipped out of the 90s. Now I think it's much more dire now. But you had some interesting perspectives when I talked to you this morning about investing in casinos and hospitality companies that actually have hard assets. Why don't you tell me about that?
What I'll articulate, I would wholeheartedly concede, is a relatively risky strategy, but without great risk, there isn't, of course, great return. So depending on your view of the economy, if you happen to take the view that the economy is going to bottom out sometime this year, find its low, you're going to want to, at some point, buy the companies that have leverage to that eventual recovery. So, in the downturn, companies that have a lot of debt, companies that own the hard underlying travel assets, they have a lot of operating leverage. They have a big fixed cost infrastructure. So when the revenue goes down, the margins get squeezed, the profits shrink rapidly. Those are the companies in the stocks, indeed, that have dramatically underperformed the broader market. Lots of investors look at these heavily levered gaming companies, names like MGM Mirage or Las Vegas Sands. They had built up massive amounts of debt because they were in the midst of a major building boom. In Las Vegas alone, there was over $30 billion of new supply being built in several multi-billion dollar projects. So when the world sort of came undone, those stocks were left holding, those companies were left holding the bag with lots of debt for assets that weren't yet open and weren't producing cash flow. Long-winded story, the point of which is the stocks were decimated, and lots of investors mm-hmm. looked at these companies and argued, well, shoot, they're clear bankruptcy risks because of all of this debt. That very same thing makes them the best potential stocks as the market begins to buy into a recovery. If you have a lot of debt, if you have a lot of hard assets, your fixed costs are very high, so when your revenue line starts to come up again, you see massive growth in profitability because your margins expand as your revenues come back to that critical mass level. The point of it all is those very same stocks are going to be the ones that dramatically outperform when the market begins to buy into a recovery scenario. The problem with that strategy is figuring out, okay, when exactly is the market going to buy into that recovery
right.
scenario? You know, of course, the market is a forward-looking animal, and you know, typically you would think a consumer cyclical discretionary business like gaming will be probably turned 6 months before the economy actually begins to turn. And if you believe there's somewhere around a mid-year bottom in the economy, well, these stocks probably make sense now. Now, if you're wrong, that's a high-risk approach, because if the economy continues to shrink, those are the very same companies that will be hit hardest by it. So it's a risky strategy, but I would argue, and I would argue for those stocks, you have potentially a quadruple in those stocks as folks buy into the recovery. Sounds crazy. Sounds like a big number.
If you look back historically at what happened to those very stocks after September 11th and what they topped out at before we bottomed out again, and understanding that this is all a cycle, those guys are in it for the long haul. You know, I mean, I don't know how many of those casino companies who are going to drop off the face of the earth. I mean, there are a lot of resources behind those companies.
Yeah, several of them. So Harrah's Entertainment, which was caught up in this private buyout scenario, and Station Casinos are both names that are on the precipice of bankruptcy. But I think a name like MGM, which has the backing of Kirk Kerkorian and
right.
a big investor in Dubai World, provide you a bit of backstop in that they probably won't let that company go under. So you have some protection on the downside. And if you look where those stocks had been at the peak of the cycle, you have potentially a long way up. So an interesting strategy, but certainly not without risk.
Right. Let's talk about the online competition. And, you've got here in the U.S. the top four players, and again, depending on how you look at it, Expedia being at the top, Travelocity, Orbitz, and Priceline. Then in Europe, you've got a number of brands that have emerged there that have been, acquired or merged with U.S. entities. The one entity that stands in Europe is Opodo, which is actually owned by Amadeus. And then in Asia, you've got Zuji and a couple of others that are joint ventures with Expedia or others. So what's your take on the rivals in that space? And are we going to end up with fewer players here in the U.S. here pretty soon?
I think we've already got, we've already consolidated down. Well, there are still hundreds and hundreds of online travel sites. The vast preponderance of online sales through third-party agencies has consolidated up to the big four. I would argue the big four are pretty much set. It's going to be very difficult for any smaller player to break in any large way. There's a upward spiraling argument. If you don't have a lot of traffic to your site, you don't get inventory to sell. If you don't have inventory, you don't get a lot of traffic to your site. If you're a small company, you can't compete to get the traffic to your site because you don't have the budget to do it, all of which, essentially keep smaller players out of the market. So if you look at the big four, are they going to be whittled down? You've seen a massive move for a smaller player in the space, Priceline. They were a fraction of the size in the U.S. of Expedia, Travelocity, and Orbitz. But throughout this downturn, they have a magic formula. They sell stuff for less. Sounds real simple. But they don't charge a booking fee on a retail plane ticket, so they
right.
sell you a ticket for $5 less. And, of course, they have that name-your-own-price product, and they save you 40%. And guess what? Discounts work in this environment. And you've
definitely.
Seen, just to throw out a data point to kind of articulate that, in the fourth quarter of this year, Priceline's domestic airline ticket volume was up more than 80%. Very difficult environment, up 80%. By comparison, Expedia down 16. So a vast disparity. You're seeing a massive move in market share towards Priceline based on that simple price disparity. I don't think Expedia goes out of business, and I think the big four are set. But I think you're seeing a pretty dramatic shift in the pretty dramatic shift in market share among the big four. Priceline moving up, Expedia moving down. On the international frontier, Priceline is the top dog. You know, and it seems to have been largely in Europe whittled down to a two-dog race between Expedia and Priceline. Most of the folks I speak to in the European marketplace, which, you know, most of the online companies are mostly selling hotels, you know, it has basically been broken down to those two, and I'm not hearing that any of the smaller players are moving up the curve at all. So I think Priceline continues to dominate here over the, you know, 12 to 24-month horizon. Mm-hmm. Expedia, they've made some inroads, but don't appear to be gaining dramatic traction.
So that makes eBookers and LastMinute.com very expensive experiments for Orbitz and Travelocity.
Yeah, you know, eBookers doesn't seem to be, you know, they've replatformed eBookers, you know, and rolled it out, and they've had some success on the top line side, but it's still losing money. So they appear to have made some headway, but not enough to move the needle.
And what's your take on the new leadership at Orbitz and Travelocity? What do you think that's going to do to shift their focus?
You know, I've actually known Barney Harper, who's stepping into the Orbitz role for a lot of years. He was with Expedia for a long time, and his background, I think, is particularly relevant in that he helped build up Expedia's merchant hotel business, helped to launch several of their international websites, ran Elong in China for a little while. The two major holes in the Orbitz platform have been their lack of hotel room sales, their lack of a, you know, good hotel product, and their, you know, limited exposure, you know, outside of the U.S. So I think his background is a perfect fit for Orbitz. It really fills the holes they've had, and I think that's a big, you know, a big improvement for them and will help them maybe close that gap. It'll take time, won't happen overnight, but I think a good step for them. At Travelocity, I held Michelle Peluso in very, very high regard, and I think her departure is going to be very difficult for them. You know, I didn't personally know her replacement very well, so I can't opine on what he brings to the table, but Michelle was certainly a big star, I think, in the industry.
Well, and again, I don't know him well either. All I can comment on is that when you bring someone who was in an operational role in a global distribution system company, you know, again, marrying buyers and sellers, but in a B2B focus, you know, shifting from B2B to B2C isn't as easy as it looks. So, you know, I certainly remain cautiously optimistic for, you know, the folks at Sabre and the folks at TPG and Silver Lake who, you know, have a pretty big investment in the success of that. So, you know, I have wondered if it somehow signals some other transaction that might be afoot. And again, I don't know anything out of school about this, but, you know, my question of, you know, how many of these do we need? You know, do we still need three GDS companies worldwide? And, of course, Abacus would be the fourth in Asia.
Yes.
And, you know, can we look at some other consolidation happening?
You know, and this goes back to the very same discussion we had on the GDSs. The same two folks that own, you know, Blackstone and TPG, Blackstone obviously owns a big slug of Orbitz, and Texas Pacific Group owns Travelocity, but they're caught in very much the same trap. You know, I think going into it, Travelport's idea was, you know, we buy, you know, Blackstone's idea, we buy Travelport, we spin off Orbitz, raise some capital, use that capital to help fund the acquisition of WorldSpan, wed that with Galileo, cut cost. Good idea.
Right.
I think Texas Pacific Group had the same idea. You know, the idea being buy Travel or, you know, buy Sabre, use Travelocity to raise capital to help consolidate potentially with Amadeus. But the credit market fell apart before they could do that. And I think they're left holding Travelocity, and Blackstone, you know, still holds 60% of Orbitz. And I think they'd like to, you know, not be in that position over the long term, but there aren't logical buyers at the moment for it. You know, Expedia and Priceline aren't likely buyers now because they're in a cash hoard mode. You know, when the markets have shut down, you keep your cash on hand. You don't spend it.
Right.
And you don't buy more of the same. You know, Expedia doesn't need a large domestic ticket seller. You know, Expedia has been deploying their capital to buy media-based alternative models to hedge against the future where ticket economics change. And I think Priceline has flown below the radar screen and bought lots of smaller things. And I wouldn't be, you know, I wouldn't see them, you know, going after one of the large OTAs. I don't think it would be a good fit for them.
Right, Right. Well, Jake, you and I could talk about this for hours, and I would love to invite you back as my co-host of the Investment Insights show again. So with that, I will just say have a great day, and I will talk to you soon.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and I'd love to join you anytime.
Okay, Jake, thanks so much. Okay, let me thank again our sponsor for the show today, which is WCities, WCities.com. For those of you who want to check out what's going on both in your own city and if you're traveling, checking out where you're going. They do have a global database, so whether you're traveling internationally or domestically, check out WCities.com. Okay, we are going to shift directions one last time for the day. We're going to be talking about growth, and I am very happy to have on the show today Joe Pine, who is an internationally acclaimed author, speaker, and management advisor. And there is so much to say about him, but I don't want to take up so much time in that that we don't get a chance to talk. Let me get Joe on the air. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning, Chickie. How are you?
I am doing great. We've had great fun today, and your name has been the name that's been bandied about by the most guests today. We started off talking about innovation and did that with Joe Calloway, and he was saying how you guys haven't worked together, but your paths have crossed a lot.
Yes, yes, and I love his work. He's comes up with great ideas.
And it actually meshes really well with your stuff. And then we switched to talking about leadership and had my friend Ken Jennings on to talk about his book, 10,000 Horses, and also The Servant Leader.
And he surprised me. Well.
I know. He surprised me by telling me that you guys went to China together.
Yeah, that was a great trip we had. That was now like 3 years ago, I think.
And what was the catalyst for you guys going together?
Well, it's actually under the auspices of an organization called English Language Institute of China that puts English teachers into China and other areas in Southeast Asia. And the head of the organization is a good friend of mine and knows Ken as well and the others that were there. And so he sort of put together this whole package to show us the country and allow us to really provide or bring our ideas to China and to business people there.
Very cool. Well, I had been introduced to you by a good friend of mine who actually also introduced me to Joe Calloway. So, Tracy Downing, thanks to you if you're listening. And actually, I had run across you, though, several years ago. I had done some work back in the early 2000 timeframe with the Carlson Organization, and they were just, I would say, students of a lot of your work. So tell us a little bit about, kind of how you got to become an author and what you focus your consulting and your coaching on.
Well, it flows out of work that I did at IBM, actually. I worked for IBM for 13 years and for the development of the AS400 system. This now reaches back 20 years, which is always surprising when I think about that. but I had... put together a group that brought in customers into the business, into the development process of the system. And I realized that every one of those customers was unremittingly unique. And we really didn't design the system for that. You know, we thought that there was a mass market out there for general purpose mini computers. And so that sent me on a search for what explains that was going on. And that led me to Stan Davis's book, Future Perfect, and he's the one that actually coined the term mass customization. And so when I read that, it was like the heavens opened up and the angels sang, because it explained everything that I was seeing. I said, you know, this is what we need to do. So I worked on getting that into our vision. Then when IBM sent me to MIT for a year, I focused my entire year on that and basically wrote a thesis that I intended to be a book and was able to do that that came out in 1993.
And you talked about it being the new frontier in business competition. As you go back and look at the premises of mass customization, is it all still true? Is it still the new frontier? What have we accomplished since 1987?
No, it's more than that now. You know, when Stan Davis coined the term in 1987, it was an oxymoron. When I wrote the book in 1993, it was the new frontier, as you point out. I think today it really is a new imperative. It is something that businesses must do to be successful today, particularly in rapidly commoditizing marketplaces, particularly when we are so used to getting things the way we want them, whether it's our coffee at Starbucks or our homepage on the internet or our tune on our iPod, that today companies have to figure out how do they get down to that individual customer.
Right, right. So then when you wrote The Experience Economy, which I guess was in 1999, is that correct?
Correct.
Which actually was right at the time that I started working on a large project with Carlson, and they were looking at the whole notion of, you know, work is theater and every business is a stage, which is the subtitle of that book. What spurred you on to that new discovery?
Well, I realized that customizing a good automatically turns it into a service. If you look at the classic economic distinctions between the two, goods are standardized, services are customized. They're done just for an individual person. Goods are inventoried after production, but services are delivered on demand when that person says this is exactly what they want. And goods are tangible and services intangible. But part and parcel of mass customization is the intangible service of helping customers figure out what it is that they want. So you customize a good, you're really in the service business. And then what I realized was, well, what happens when you customize a service? And I realized if you customize a service, if you do exactly what this particular person needs at this moment in time, then you can't help but make them go wow and turn into a memorable event. So that led me to realize that experiences were in fact a distinct economic offering, and therefore we would have an economy based off of experiences. And once I realized that, you know, you just saw everything in a different light, and you could see what was going on. You could see how much that was moving. You know, from what Disney does as the world's premier experience stager to the rise of theme restaurants and boutique hotels to experiential retail and to manufacturers, you know, even getting into the experience business by creating places where people can experience their goods like American Girl Place or Apple stores today. And so there really is this fundamental shift in the very fabric of the economy that's going on. As goods and services are everywhere being commoditized, what consumers are looking for are experiences, are memorable events that engage them in an inherently personal way.
And, Joe, what happens in the current economic crisis with those events? I loved, actually, on your website, you've got a video of you speaking, which I listened to the other night. Just to get, you know, further background on
I love it when a host does her homework.
Oh, I tell you what, though, but that's the really fun part of this job. But you tell a story which is near and dear to my heart because I've got an 8-year-old and a 10-year-old, and you tell a story about birthday parties.
Yes.
And the other night at the dinner table, actually it was last night, you know, the kids are aware that belts are tightening, not just in our household, but all over the country. And they were talking about what they were going to do with their birthday party this year. And it's not going to be, you know, the $200 to $400 extravaganza that we've had in the past. So what's going to happen with thinking about experience as being core to people's brands?
Well, a lot of people are raising that question right now. You know, of course, as we're going through these troubling times with an economic crisis, particularly in the financial services industry, and one of the things to realize is that it doesn't really change the shift that's going on, you know, any more than the Depression changed the shift from an agrarian to an industrial economy, or the recessions and the malaise of the 1970s changed the shift from industrial to a service economy. You know, that is going to happen at pace no matter what. You know, absent a global cataclysm. But it does shift things around. It does slow things down a bit. But people still are going to want their experiences. But what they may do is they may shift from the $200 extravaganza, as you say, to an experience that they create for themselves. But maybe mm-hmm. they put more into it, knowing that they're foregoing something that they wanted to do.
Right. We actually got a birthday party invitation last week from a friend down the street, and it said birthday goes retro. And they actually said that we were going to play all the kinds of games that you knew that the parents played at their birthday parties,
right.
You know, back in the 60s.
The clothespin and the bottle, I remember that, right?
Yeah. I mean, I just thought it was so funny because, yeah, you're right. And, you know, I mean, I tell people, we just got off the phone with Jake Fuller from Travel Industry Investment Perspective, and I tell investors in the travel industry all the time that, you know, people aren't going to stop traveling. They're just going to change the experience.
Right.
If they used to go down the Nile on a small river cruise, then maybe they're going to experience the Lewis and Clark River experience up in Oregon.
Exactly.
Or maybe, you know, if they used to go wine tasting in Italy, maybe now they're going to go and experience again, you know, Oregon. I always use as my example.
Right. Well, and you know, maybe somebody from Germany who loves to go to Disney World instead goes to Euro Disney.
Exactly.
Or somebody here, instead of going, to Disney World, goes to a Six Flags.
Right. And the cool thing, you know, I mean, and I say this because I have made my livelihood from the travel industry the bulk of my life, is that the travel industry is actually one of the first to rebound in the economy. And, you know, the travel industry is really all about experience. But I want to kind of lead you into talking about your third book, Authenticity. Because that, and again, the tagline on that book I love, it's what customers really want. And I think right now I see people all around me going through, the what they want or what they thought they used to want and really getting down to what they really want and what they really need. And that's what's driving, you know, some of the economic situation that we have. So tell me about the thinking behind getting ready to write that book and what research you did on that front.
Well, you know, every one of our books seems to flow out of the previous one.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it is all part of one worldview. I mean, they aren't just totally different subjects that we go off and investigate like some people do, but it's just a matter of observing what's going on in the world and trying to make sense of it. And when my partner Jim Gilmore and I went out and started talking about the experience economy, we realized increasingly that people would bring up issues of authenticity all the time. You know, particularly when I would go to Europe, where in the question answer period, the first question was often not a question but an accusation, and usually began with the two words, "You Americans," you know, where they'd point out that they thought that we liked these fantasy, these Disneyland sort of environments, whereas in Europe they like their real, their natural, their authentic experiences. And so it got us thinking about it, and we realized that people the world over, in fact, craved authenticity. And it's just sort of a natural thing when experiences come to the fore, issues of authenticity follow closely behind. I mean, look at the birthday party discussion. You know, people then say, well, is Chuck E. Cheese really an authentic birthday? Right? Or
not in my book.
Yeah, right, not in your book. And so the retro birthday party, the one with those old-fashioned games to us, you know, as baby boomers in particular, seems incredibly authentic. That's what we need to provide to our kids. And so you have this push towards not away from experiences but towards authentic experiences. And also to where it impacts not just experiences, but every economic offering. I mean, whether it's a commodity, a good, a service, or experiences, people want the real from the genuine, not the fake from some phony. So you see, for example, in commodities, you see the rise of organic produce and, you know, free-range chickens and things like that. In goods and services as well, we're looking for real connections to the product and real connections to people. We're looking for human service, you know, where you call up a call center, you know, for some company, and today you're surprised when you get a real human, much less the fact that you've got to modify the word human with the word real, which we didn't used to have to do.
Right.
And all of that, you know, really leads into this craving for authenticity.
Right, and, you know, of course, that still has to be balanced with good business. I mean, I live in Florida, and our major grocery store here is Publix, and, you know, they, like most grocery stores, came out with their own brand of the organics, and, you know, I'll just use milk as the example because I'm not great at remembering prices, as my husband will attest. But, you know, they started off with a separate green brand, which, you know, had hormone-free on the front. And, you know, that's really, really important to me that I'm not serving my kids' milk with hormones in it. But the milk was literally two times the price.
Yep.
And it's interesting, over the course of the last, I'll say, 3 years since we first started buying that milk, they actually took the special brand off of the shelf and made their normal Publix brand hormone-free. And, you know, it might be more expensive than it used to be, but it's not twice the price.
Right.
And so authenticity has to also be somehow reasonable. And so
right.
maybe the definition of authenticity is getting adjusted as we go.
Yeah, that could be. And one of the things to realize is that, you know, what you're talking about still are product innovations. You know, hormone-free is an innovation that didn't used to be there. And with any innovation, it always starts off at a higher price, and companies are able to pick off those people for whom it really has value, that it matters
right.
to them. And then over time, they bring down the price as they're able to increase production, you know, because organic used to be a very small piece. It used to be very difficult to do, but what companies and farmers have done is that they've figured out how to be able to do it. So those people that were willing to buy it at a very high price early on are actually subsidize the continuing development of that offering so that its price can, in fact, be lowered over time as its cost is lowered.
And I just want to take a short break here and just let those who are listening know that if you would like to ask a question, in the center of the screen on the Blog Talk Radio page is a chat button, and you can ask a question of Joe, and I will pass that on to him. And would also like to thank again W Cities, our sponsor. Joe, let's talk about what happens in a typical engagement. A CEO calls you, and, you know, they've been through the gamut. They've done cost cutting. They've done brand building. You know, they've tried a lot of things. And, you know, understanding that these are tough economic times, they're stagnant. Their people aren't excited. In fact, they're really having a tough time right now keeping morale up. What's the initial dialogue that you have with that CEO?
Well, the key is to understand where they're at in their own journey. You know, some people call with saying, you know, they've just heard about this idea and they don't know much about it and they want to learn more. It says, okay, well, you know, come in and talk to you and your management team and really get people to understand what's going on and what, therefore, they need to do differently. In other cases, they already recognize that, hey, they've really got to do something here. Maybe they made some progress. They've got some initiatives, but they're not all aligned. And that requires more, you know, fuller work to be able to sit down and say, okay, let's go through an engagement where you figure out what it is that you need to do, what your intention really is. And then everything that flows from that to create the alignment of a set of initiatives that all work together to be able to make the difference that you want and come out with the new experience that you need.
Mm-hmm. So how do you get it from a dialogue with a leader in an organization to be something that permeates the culture? Because I would assume that in order for a company to change from a product or a service orientation into an experience orientation, they have to do something different
yep.
throughout the way that they think about things, what they focus on. How do you get them there?
Yeah, well, when I'm doing a full engagement with a company that requires going to that level of depth, I do that at Storizon, which is an experience design place in Keystone, Colorado, in which I'm a partner.
Mm-hmm.
And we bring people to Storizon to get them out of their normal ways of doing things. And that's one of the first things.
And how do you spell Storizon?
Storizon. And you can
cool.
learn more at storizon.org.
Oh, definitely.
And it's an amazing place because what we did as a consulting company is we applied our own experience design methodology to ourselves first, before exposing it to customers. So you encounter an experience, one that is customized for you. one that gets you out of your ordinary way of thinking and leaving your baggage behind so that you can really think anew about what you're trying to do with the organization, with your offerings, with the experience that you want to create for your customers or for your employees. And part of the process that we go through includes exactly the issues that you're raising. It's basically six different facets of experience design that we call the six I's, because they all begin with the letter I. You know, the first one, as I mentioned, is intentional, where you figure out what you want to do and what your theme is for the experience, and everything has to flow from that, because otherwise you'll never get alignment.
Right.
Then the last two I's address specifically what you're talking about. They're inspiration and institute. An inspiration is about inspiring your people to really want to make a difference, to really want to change, as well as inspiring your customers to want the new experience that you are designing. And then institute is about making it last, ensuring that what you've created is as great an experience 3, 4, 5 years down the road as it is the first day you put it in place.
You know, Joe, as I look at the experience economy, and I have to admit that as I was reading it, you know, some of the examples up front, you know, they make total sense for someone like Nike to create, you know, this big experiential store. And I don't recall whether you mentioned Apple Computer, but the Apple stores are very,
yep,
very much an experience. And you just alluded to the fact that you use the process for your own consulting. So if you don't have a physical product, how do you think differently about incorporating both the experience side of things and authenticity? Are there things that you need to stop doing in your business?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I mean, if you don't have a physical product, generally what you have then are interactions. You know, then you're in the service business. And that's actually easier than to create an experience around it, because it's how do you take mundane interactions and turn them into engaging encounters. And there are many ways to do that, and some of them back to, as you mentioned earlier, the subtitle of the experience economy is that work is theater and every business is stage. Well, if you bring theater to bear, that's the key way. I mean, think about installing and repairing computers, you know, pretty much as mundane interaction as you can have, an interaction you don't even want to have because it means your computer's broken, right?
Right.
And then think about doing it like the Geek Squad does, where they have this entire cool geek persona to them, where they, you know, are costumed in white shirts and thin black ties, where they drive in their black and white Beetles that look like squad cars, the Geekmobiles,
mm-hmm,
and where they show their badge and so forth. They create a wonderful experience because of the theater that they bring to. Right, I was reading a blog entry this morning that popped up on Pike Place Fish Market. Have you ever been out there in Seattle?
Yes, yes.
Right, so here's not a physical product in the sense of a manufactured good, but it's an actual commodity. But you know, a fish that they get out of the ocean and put on ice in an open air market. But they again do it with such wonderful theater, and that people come the world over to be able to experience them, including the signature moment of them throwing the fish once you've ordered it. But also, when I visit there, it's amazing how authentic the place is as well. I mean, those are real fishmongers there. They smell like fish when they go home. The Geek Squad, special agents, double agents, counterintelligence units, they're all real geeks. I mean, that's who they are. And that's what you need to do. You need to find within yourself what is your heritage, what flows from who you are as a company, from your heritage as an organization, and how you manifest that self in a way that your customers will perceive as real.
And can you deliver measurable growth using this process of this transformation, I will call it?
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's the whole point. And the reason you're growing is because you're actually delivering the value that customers are looking for. You know, I think we both mentioned now Apple stores. But I remember when the Apple stores first came out in like 2001, 2002, where people said they were crazy, that this will never work. They're a manufacturer, not a retailer. What are they doing getting into retail? Well, now over half of Apple's income, its revenue, is from its own stores.
Really?
Where over 225 stores are getting an average of $4,000 per square foot, which is an order of magnitude more than the average retailer. Why? Because of, well, one, they got great products, right? You need great products.
Right.
Right?
Yeah,
but,
well, you have to be authentic about that,
well,
too.
Exactly. And but the experience they design around those products to get you to interact with them, even how they check out, how they have the theater in there for classes, the Genius Bar and so forth, all of those just render authenticity in tremendous ways, and they lead to growth. I was, you know, Jim and I give out an Experience Stage of the Year award every year to an organization that really exemplifies their principles. And the very first one we gave out in 1999, which we didn't find out until we had finished writing the book, unfortunately, was American Girl Place. And there, again, is a manufacturer that created retail places, not stores so much as experience places.
Oh. Trust me, I've got a 10-year-old daughter. I thoroughly understand what they've created.
Right. Well, you know, because you can walk into an American Girl Place and spend hundreds of dollars without buying a thing, just for the admission fee experiences that they have inside of there.
Isn't that amazing?
Well, you know, so I was just reading last week about Mattel's results. And what do they say? Well, they say, you know, Barbie is down 21% and Fisher-Price is down, you know, 18% or whatever it was and so on and so forth. And then it said, oh, by the way, American Girl is up 5%.
Well, you know, the first time I ever entered an American Girl store was in New York City. And I stood in line almost with my mouth open,
mm-hmm.
saying, I've got to find out who owns this,
yes.
and invest in them. And, man, don't I wish I had. And when I found out it was Mattel, I was actually stunned.
Yeah, they actually bought it shortly after the first one opened in Chicago in late 1998. I think in summer 1999 they bought the company.
Yeah, I mean, I was truly stunned because, I mean, granted, I mean, Barbie's been an amazing brand and you know, certainly has lasted many, many, many years. And it'll be interesting to see how long the lifespan, you know, of American Girl will be. Because, again, right now, you know, perhaps we can't afford the dolls, and my daughter is getting a little bit out of the doll stage. But, man, does she love the books and the movies. So the brand extension of taking that experience into other genres and other product types, I think, is also brilliant.
Right, exactly. Let's
talk about that for a minute, because I can tell you, you know, I mean, I'm just going through this whole reinvention of myself and taking the brand solutions, which has existed for 13 years. Well, actually, my personal brand has existed for 13 years, but the solutions brand's been around for 4. And, you know, taking it into branding a show like Solutions Live, is that whole thing a part of how you help people grow? I mean, where does brand sit in the center of this whole experience issue?
Well, brand, you know, we're not
actually
really...
I have to be fair to you. I have to tell you, we only have 2 minutes left. So that,
okay,
that,
well,
wasn't a fair question to throw out.
Well, this is a big
maybe
question,
we'll
right?
have another. How about if we do this? How about if we schedule another show to talk about branding? And why don't I just ask you in the last minute or so that we actually have here, What's the one thing about experience and authenticity that you would like to leave people with?
Well, it gets into a little bit of branding. I'd love to do a second show with you, Chicky. But the key thing to understand is there are two key standards of authenticity. One, being true to self, you know, which is a self-directed task, which is understanding mm-hmm. who you are as an organization, as a company, what flows from your heritage, from a founder like a Pleasant Roland at American Girl, a Steve Jobs at Apple, and remaining true to that in every decision that you make.
Right.
And then two is being what you say you are to others. So not self-directed, that's other focus. That's looking at how you represent yourself in your marketing, in your packaging, in anything that you say about it, and how to make sure that what customers encounter when they buy from you is, in fact, how you represent yourself.
Right.
If you don't do either one of those, you'll be perceived as phony.
Well, that is really, really great advice. What this whole show is about leaving a legacy. And I'm going to thank you and ask you, Joe, if we can get together offline and schedule that other session. You have a really, really wonderful day.
All right. Thank you. I look forward to it.
Take care.
Yep, bye-bye.
Don't mind if you got something nice to say about me. I enjoy an accolade like the rest. If you could take my picture and hang it in a gallery of all the who's who's and so-and-so's that used to be the best.
Insights on social networking and faith in the marketplace. Go out and begin to leave your legacy today.
For more information, see www.solutionsmarketing.com.